911, what's your emergency?
I'm in me dad's car. Vroom, vroom. Well, welcome back to the First Res Podcast, guys. It has been so long.
It feels like it's been so long. It's been like probably, what, 2 weeks since we recorded an episode?
Yeah. So this is a very fun episode because not only is it the season three premiere, a very beloved premiere in 911 canon, but also this episode is going up the day after the season eight finale, the Don't Drink the Water part two. And so
it's called Seismic Shifts.
Oh, sorry,
it's seismic, not called shifts. Don't Drink the Water part two.
Seismic Shifts, sorry. I'm assuming they're doing Earthquake the Revenge, you know.
Right, Earthquake 2 Electric Boogaloo. This time it's personal.
Exactly. And so we haven't seen 818. We have seen 8, 16 and 17. Do you have any opinions or thoughts?
Not really. No. You guys already know we have a controversial opinion, which is basically just that we thought both episodes were good.
Yeah.
The fandom seems pretty solidly like episode 16 was the worst shit ever, and then 17 was good and amazing, and why couldn't 16 be as good as 17? I don't even know that I want to get into it that much. I feel like I'm going to make a video about season 8, and when I do that and do my rewatch, whatever I have to say about the fandom reaction, I will sort out exactly what I want to say then. Our other big piece of news is that we are finally launching our long fabled Patreon that we've been like alluding to over the last few months as if we have one slash are about to make one, and then we just haven't had time to make one. But we're doing it. We're trying to get it launched today, the same day we are posting this episode.
Yes. So if you guys are interested in supporting us financially for this podcast, which is a real labor of love for Jane and I, you can go to patreon.com/firstrespodcast and give us all your money. And in return, this is not a one-way transaction. We will be providing goods and services. We will be doing monthly bonus episodes on various 911 adjacent topics.
We recently recorded our very first one, which is about an iconic 911 adjacent piece of media, the Ryan Guzman erotic thriller, The Boy Next Door. So if you're interested in hearing that, do check it out. Yeah. And, you know, over the next few months, we'll accumulate kind of a backlog of these things, and we think it'll be really fun. This, you know, we don't want anyone to think we're, like, selling out, but we've always kind of, as we've discussed before, we do put in kind of a lot of labor, like, doing this every single week, and we have just been wondering how we can monetize it. We've never really been interested in, like, sponsorships or, like, trying to put ads on this show, because I know I always find that really annoying when you're, you know, I often listen to podcasts to like fall asleep, so I always hate when suddenly you get interrupted by like a really poorly mixed ad for like Casper mattresses or whatever. We don't really want to have to do that. And I've always loved the Patreon model because you get to like actually offer something in return for people's support. So I think it'll be really fun. It'll be kind of like an exclusive little community.
Yes.
And yeah, we've got a few different tiers. I hope you guys are proud of us for the names of our tiers we came up with. We've got a $2 tier called the Probies. Okay. That's for any firehouse new blood. We've got our $4 tier, which is Girls Who Got Stuck. our $8 tier, Real Life Trucks. And we have like a stretch tier that's our $20 tier that we don't really expect anyone to subscribe to, but it is called Buddy Cannon.
Buddy Cannon.
And, you know, my concept there, Buddy Cannon, my concept there is like Buddy Cannon is kind of wishful thinking. Like, we don't know if it's going to happen, but it'd be really nice if it happened. just like people paying us $20 a month to make a podcast. So, you know, that's our stretch here. And our concept, we're kind of going with the Jenny Nicholson concept, classic us ripping off Jenny Nicholson.
Yes.
We're doing like at the like $4 tier, you can vote on topics for bonus episodes. And at the $8 one, you can suggest them. I'm of the mind that like we probably won't have enough subscribers right away to have like people suggesting a lot of topics. So if that turns out to be the case, like we have some topics in mind that we can throw into the ring right now. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that's our concept. And, you know, no pressure at all. We always intend to keep the podcast free. That was kind of our goal with the Patreon as well, is like, yes, we don't want to like gatekeep anything. So it's just like, if you feel like supporting us, or if you feel like hearing a little more of our weird 911 tangents and whatnot, that's just a thing you can check out. We'll have the link in our description, on all our social medias, etc.
We are very excited about this. Thank you for supporting us. We really appreciate it. We appreciate all the love. We just passed 1,000 monthly followers on Spotify.
Yeah.
And we are filled with gratitude. So thank you so much for supporting our show. And now on to the episode.
So today we are discussing season 3, episode 1, Kids Today.
Yes.
Do we think this episode was named after the song from Bye Bye Birdie?
Like, it is a Ryan Murphy production, so I wouldn't be surprised. However, I would need a needle drop if that's the case. I would need like I would need to them at least like have like a call involving like a high school production of Bye Bye Birdie.
Oh, I would love that. My sister played Kim in her high school production of Bye Bye Birdie.
Did she really? Oh my god, that's such a formative show for like a lot of young people, and I'm so pissed that like I never got to do that show, because I feel like I would have like
I was never in it. Mm-hmm. But I saw her production a few times.
Yeah, that would have been like my like a real like formative experience for me, was being in that show, because I really like that show. I think it's well done.
But this episode was directed by Jennifer Lynch, of course, and written by Kristen Rydell, my misunderstood queen. So we have a bit of a like girl boss dream team on this episode.
Oh, this is awesome. Okay, well,
and
it
yes,
begins...
I recently embarrassed myself on Twitter because I thought the latest episode of 911 was written by Kristen Rydell, because that's what IMDb said. Okay, and I've always considered IMDb a reliable source, but these days, at least in the 911 space, it's becoming like Wikipedia, where just like anybody can edit it, which I guess was always true, but like maybe people only kind of just recently realized they can wield that power. So now like you just can't rely on it for like the cast credits, the crew credits. It's really annoying. But anyway, episode 17 was not written by Kristen Rydell. I spoke too soon.
So I wasn't going to bring that up. But I'm glad that you did, so we can clear the air on that front. Yes. Yeah, so
listen,
it was...
everybody makes mistakes, even perfect, intelligent, beautiful people like me.
This episode was written by Kristen Rydell, and it was directed by Jennifer Lynch. And it begins with a high speed chase with OJ. So this car is barreling down the freeway at 105.
Okay, it took me like 5 seconds to realize what you meant by that.
it's barreling down the freeway at 105 miles per hour, and there's this scared little 15-year-old kid who probably doesn't even have his permit, let alone a license, driving it. And this is a very interesting call to me, because it's based on a very infamous 911 call that it's legendary in like horror YouTube space as like the top five freakiest 911 calls. Like if you've ever seen like one of those videos, this is like
really.
Oh yeah,
because I looked this up too, and I found the story. I assume we're talking about the same story. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it was like one of those freaky 911 calls that people talk about.
Oh yeah, the call is archived and public, and so you can like listen to like the harrowing events. It's grisly. Don't do it. So there's this real life incident of this family that was on the freeway. They were driving down the freeway, and their brakes stopped working. Their brakes just cut out. And they were going fast. They were going like over 75, 90, you know, whatever. It's a freeway. You drive fast. And the brakes stop working. The dad calls 911. He's freaking out, and he has no idea what to do. the dispatcher isn't able to the dispatcher isn't Maddie Buckley, let's just say that. So the 118 isn't able to respond. This is a real life tragedy. I shouldn't be making light of this, but basically the you hear on the call, the car approaches an intersection, massive crash, cuts out. It's grisly. It's a real thing that happened.
I looked into this and I found a different story. And not to yuck your yum, but I think the one I found might actually be the basis of the call in 911.
Hello.
Because I found a happier story. In 2012, there was a woman driving on the highway and her gas pedal got stuck. And she, you know, accelerated and accelerated. She got caught in this like 110 mile per hour police chase, just like on the show. And she dialed 911. And the dispatcher ended up helping her. She came up with not the same solution we see on the show, but got her to like pull the emergency brake while doing something else at the same time. And the car managed to stop. And in real life, the woman ended up meeting up with and thanking the 911 dispatcher who helped her. So I found this little news feature about like this heartwarming story of she meets up with the 911 dispatcher. And I thought, oh, this must have been the inspiration for the show because it has such a kind of unusual focus on the dispatcher. Mm-hmm. And it also had a happy ending. Like the woman lived, she was fine.
So
and she didn't hit any other cars.
So that's probably the one that was used as the basis then. I love that you went to the more, the happier ending one that was probably the basis. And I went to, so this is a story from the Dregs of Horror YouTube. And you can still listen to the archived 911 call.
I mean, it's possible that both were the inspiration. I guess it makes sense that this has happened more than once. It's such a scary idea. I already am kind of afraid of driving. That's why I still don't have my license. I can't imagine getting into a situation like this.
Yeah, if you can, if you ever find yourself in this situation, the best thing to do if you can is to put your car in neutral allow like sort of the momentum to gradually come to a stop if you have the space and the time to do so. Obviously, in this call on the show, the clutch was stuck, so it was stuck. It was stuck. He couldn't do that. In the episode, there's this teenage guy. He's driving this like vintage, like sexy ass, like 1970 Ferrari. It's said to be one of a kind.
It's a yellow convertible.
It's a gorgeous car. He has his AirPods in, and Athena, you know,
he can't hear us. He has AirPods in.
Athena's like chasing him down. She's like, we got a joyrider. You know, we gotta stop him before he hurts someone. And then he himself ends up calling 911 because he can't stop the car. It's stuck on the accelerator or the brakes don't work. And it won't go into neutral. And it turns out that this kid, this 15-year-old kid, he took his dad's car out to show his friends because none of them believed that such a square family would have such a cool car. Apparently, the dad loves this car more than anything. He loves his car more than his son. He doesn't even drive it
because
he's afraid of damaging this car. Apparently, all he does is sit in it in the garage and listen to Phil Collins. Which, can I just say, I hate Phil Collins. I hate Phil Collins. And this,
so you must hate Disney's Tarzan.
I low-key, like, yeah. And I, you know, I also hate this dad because he's such a type.
I kinda
you know
do
what I mean?
Too.
The car dad. He's such a type. The car dad that sits and listens to Phil Collins instead of spending time with his son. Ugh. You know? And he like works like a corporate job too. Like he's in a suit. It's just, I don't like this guy.
I agree. So Maddie like tells Athena what's going on. She asks if it's real. And Josh has this great line where he says, "I think children as a rule are pathological liars." And you're like, whoa, what's the lore there? You know, is he just like mean gay guy who hates kids? Because I think that's kind of a type too, right?
Very much a type. As someone who debatably falls under that category, I get it.
I don't hate kids. I just wouldn't have them. But he says to Athena, "This kid sounds pretty scared." So they're trying to figure out how to get the car to stop. They end up calling the 118. Who we see them at the station. It's the 118 minus Buck, because, you know, he is still a little out of commission.
Yeah.
But Maddie gets on the phone with the dad, the Phil Collins dad. This dad, she tells him, like, your son thinks that you love the car more than you love him. We've got to get you on the phone with the kid. You need to convince him that he is more important than the car. The dad gets on the phone. This is what made me dislike the dad. He is not good at conflict resolution, no. And he is not good at convincingly telling his son that he loves him. You know, like, he's just, like, super, he's, like, trying to console his kid, but he's also clearly, like, still really worried about the car.
Yeah.
And it's, like, played for laughs, but you're like, damn.
And, like,
your kid is in this dangerous situation and you can't just, like, forget about the car for a second.
Even the kid was weirded out. I mean, like, you know, like, like, he's like, starts to, like, hyperventilate and freak out because he thinks he's gonna die, and his dad is coming on, yeah, to say, like, I love you, like, one last time, because, like, his son is gonna die.
Because this is so out of character for his dad, that the son accident. Is like, oh, I must be about to die, and that's right. Sad in itself, because it's like, oh, your dad would never normally tell you he loves you or whatever.
Oh man. Like,
right, it's pretty depressing.
Yeah, it is. And then, you know, they sort of start to come up with a plan about, like, how to slow this car down to a stop. And it involves big rig over the road racing. They get the ladder truck, the dreaded ladder truck out there. And they make the kid take the off ramp. Maddie has him start pressing on the brakes. So the brakes apparently do still kind of work.
But the car starts to, like, violently shake whenever he uses the brakes, which is why he hasn't really been using them.
We get a Phil Collins needle drop. So,
oh yeah. Oh,
great,
yeah.
Great way to start
in the
this
air
season.
Tonight.
The fire truck rolls up onto the off ramp, positions itself in front of the car, and Maddie has him pull the emergency brake. By the way, one thing you should never ever do, just, like, in any scenario other than, I guess, this one, is when a car is moving, like, above, like, you know, 30 miles per hour, never pull the emergency brake.
Yeah, can that, like, flip the car or something?
Yeah, it can flip the car and everyone inside will die. Like, don't do it. He pulls the brake and it works. The car smashes into the fire truck. There's no airbag, so his face just ricochets off of the yeah, steering wheel. And then it comes to a close, and Eddie,
by the way, they have him hit the car right as the famous, like, drum fill in the air tonight.
Yeah.
I thought that was a good detail.
Yeah. And then
I do always think the needle drop is odd because it feels like such an iconic 911 style song to use in a 911 call on this show. Mm-hmm. And I feel like they kind of wasted it on a call that isn't really relevant to the song. And I feel like proof of this is the fact that they reused In the Air Tonight for the Be NATO promos. I don't think they used the song in the actual episode, but they used it in the promos. And it's like, yeah, guys, In the Air Tonight by Phil Collins would have been way better for the Bee episode.
Or a gas
there are
leak,
bees
you
in
know?
The air tonight.
There needs to be something in the air,
gas
right?
Leak, yeah.
But, like, I'm thinking about, like, what other coming. Phil Collins song would have been, like, good for this scenario. It's not really, like, a singer that's, like, his discography lends itself. Like, what? Like, he's like, take a look at me now.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest with you. Outside of In the Air Tonight and Take a Look at Me Now, I pretty much only know his songs from the Tarzan movie.
Which is honestly probably the best way to embrace his, to engage with his discography. Because it's not.
I want to know.
It's not stellar.
Can you show me? Come on. That soundtrack's catchy. He does have, like, a very corny style, so I get why you don't like him.
It's just, it's like the same reason I don't like the Foo Fighters. You know, it's dadcore, and, like, all of the songs, like, sound the same. And they have, like, a sound that, like, I don't connect with at all. So I'm just like, this music is, like, it's, like, a prime example of, like, music that's made for someone that is the complete opposite of me.
Fair enough.
You know? Yeah. But basically they get the kid out of the car, you know, they're checking him out. And then dad's on the scene. He's doing his worried dad thing. They're like, you know, what could have caused this to happen? And Eddie finds a loose clutch. Yeah, the clutch was loose. it happens sometimes in vintage cars. They're not restored properly, or sometimes just the mechanics themselves just fall apart. It happens. Get tune-ups, get, you know, brake checks, all that stuff, especially if you're driving a vintage car. But it's actually kind of a touching moment, because like the kid is so worried that his dad is gonna, like, you know, strangle him like Homer Simpson, and yeah. Instead he says, you know, there's another vintage car on auction. I think he says it's like a 1968 or something, so it's even older, even more vintage. And says maybe we can check that one out. And so it's like, oh, that's kind of nice. Kind of nice. He learned to value his son's life.
Exactly. He got more genuinely concerned by the end. But anyway, the kid goes away in the ambulance, and Athena says, "Kids today."
Yeah.
The title of the episode.
And then you'd expect like the title card, but instead it just goes to commercial. And so, like,
yeah, the title card happened earlier.
Yeah, I completely missed the title card. Genuinely thought
it's kind of a random one
that there wasn't even one this episode. I thought there wasn't
one. I think it happens like right after the kid gets on the phone with Maddie and tells her that he can't stop, basically.
Yeah.
That's what I remember.
And then so yeah, kids today, cut to commercial, and then come back from commercial, and we're in what appears to be some sort of call. Right, in the middle of it, Buck's in a burning building. There's apples on the ground. I think the apples are right to the core. What?
Dude, you missed. These are not apples. These are fucking baby doll heads.
I thought those were fucking apples.
No, I kind of did too when I first saw the shot. But then that is so funny that you even started doing the Charlie XCX song. No, does she have a song called like Dismembered Baby Dolls? That sounds like something she would do.
No, I'm trying to think of like, I think about it all the time. Oh, how I might run out of time. Because I finally found my baby, and a baby might be mine.
And a baby might be mine.
Maybe that one.
Yeah, that one works. Yeah. So Buck is surrounded by, in this apparent burning building, he's surrounded by baby doll parts. I was like, okay. He finds what looks like a passed out person on the floor. So he like jumps down, gets this person out of the building. And we realize that this has all been an elaborate, like, drill. He is being assessed for whether he's cleared to come back to work or not.
It's so simulation.
Testing him,
it's
says,
a simulation. Oh,
yes,
my God.
It's all a
the
simulation.
The LAFD controls the simulation. And he gets out of the Matrix, and he takes the red pill.
Hell yeah.
And saves that doll woman. And he is reinstated because he passed all of his exams. Good for Buck.
Well, and this is where you get context. The guy giving the test says, "Baby doll factory, new record."
And so it's like this is like a recurring simulation for these like firefighters.
I guess. Well, I assumed when I realized it was baby parts. I assumed because we see sometimes when they are doing like firefighter academy stuff, we see them rescuing like baby dolls like that are meant to be babies. So I thought, oh, like he's doing the testing. Maybe it's like supposed to be like fake babies, but no, apparently the simulation was supposed to be a baby doll factory that's on fire, which is such a camp choice.
So but also that. Imagine the alternative. Imagine how grisly it would be. It would be like a particularly harrowing episode of like SVU. Like you go into this like
just a burning building covered in dismembered babies.
God. I don't think they would let that on like any network. I don't think even HBO would sign off on that. They'd be like, this is
that
too
might
tasteless.
Be more of a TVMA thing.
Yeah. but he passes his exam. We get a come and get your love needle drop.
Yes, we do.
Guardians of the Galaxy fans will remember this one.
We'll remember.
Or, you know, red boneheads, I guess.
If such a thing exists. Yeah, we cut to Michael and Athena's house. And Hen and Karen are arriving at this surprise welcome back party for Buck that's being hosted at Athena's house. We hear that Karen is getting IVF shots, and these are like making her emotional because of all the hormonal stuff. Yep. Eddie comes through with a platter of food. I thought this was cute. And, you know, Bobby's grilling or something. Everybody's getting ready. Buck and Maddie show up. And at first, Athena's kind of leading them in like, oh, I'm so glad you guys are coming over. And then they do the surprise party thing.
Yeah.
Buck looks so genuinely scared for a moment.
So scared. I will say, throughout this episode, Oliver Stark's acting choices have been like the choices of like, like a mad thespian, like not like mad like emotionally, like mad like psychologically, and I'm just like very obsessed with them.
Yeah, he's like, inspired in this episode, I think.
I agree. It's like he was like possessed by like, you know, his like thespian forebears to, you know, make this one his like his best one yet, you know. Like previews are done, this is opening
night. British.
Yes.
But yeah, anyway, he shows up. He hugs Eddie first, of course. This is a classic buddy hug. Come on. Mm-hmm. It's cute. Mm-hmm. Buck's like holding his waist. I have to say, Eddie has a new haircut this season. Classic Eddie thing for him to do. He's got like it very cropped, kind of a buzz cut. And I feel like this is a controversial haircut. Some people really like it. Some people really don't. I like this haircut. I think it looks good on him.
I like this one. I think it frames his face well. He has the bone structure to pull
this
kind of thing off.
It shows off his gorgeous face.
Yeah, I agree. It like it brings his hair out of his face just so that we can see it all in all its glory. Yeah, no, it's nice. It looks good. I will say I did have like something of a jump scare seeing Ryan Guzman in this episode, just because the last time I saw him was when we watched The Boy Next Door for the pod. And so
was thinking of The Boy Next Door in the like car chase scene, because I was thinking of that scene in The Boy Next Door where the kid like has lost control of his brakes, remember? Yeah. It's kind of similar.
Yeah, it is kind of similar. The cross-pollination continues. So I just had my my birthday. I turned 25, and for my party, instead of going to like a bar or a club like I normally do, I had a bunch of friends over, and we had a bad movie night, and we got very drunk.
I was meaning to ask you what you ended up watching.
We ate a lot of food, and we watched, I want to say, I think we watched 9 movies, because we instated a veto policy. Right, where after 20 minutes you could veto a movie.
That's great.
And we vetoed a lot of movies. We watched. Let me get the full list. Okay, I'll be right back.
Yeah, I want to hear it.
So what we did was we each put in 2 suggestions into a hat, and then we drew films from a hat. And so the first movie that we watched was Amelia Perez.
That movie is miserable. Like, I don't think you can even put that one on for like bad movie watching. It's just so miserable to watch.
Yeah, that was the first one that we watched. It got vetoed so quickly.
I'm sure.
And it was just such a crazy moment of like, that's the first movie that we pull out of the hat is fucking Emilia Perez, Best Picture nominee. We got to the rhinoplasty, yes. Vaginoplasty, yes. We got to that scene and then we just stopped.
Yeah, that's really the highlight of the movie. Like, that's all you need to see.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Everything else was just absolute like just miserable
slog.
Viewing experience.
Yeah.
Then the next movie that we watched was so much fun, and we really loved it, but we had to see what the rest of the choices were, so we vetoed it as well. It was Party Monster, based on the documentary and I believe a novel as well about James St. James and the club kids of the 1980s. It's starring Macaulay Culkin and Seth Green doing their best bad gay guy impressions. It's so funny. That movie's amazing. It looks like it was made on a budget of like 2, but it had a budget of like $5 million.
Yeah.
That movie's fantastic. Go watch it. My only note was that I wanted Seth Green to be doing the Chris Griffin voice the whole time. And then afterwards, after that, we watched Tom Hooper's Cats.
That one I also think is a miserable one to watch.
No, we cheered so hard when that came up. We cheered so hard.
Like, you go into it thinking it'll be fun, but then it's just kind of miserable and nightmarish. That was my experience.
For you, maybe. That is like my favorite bad movie of all time, I think.
Tom
Hooper's Cats. I literally gave it a 5 stars on Letterboxd because I emotionally love it so much.
Okay, fair.
After that, we watched Disney's Zombies, which is like the clumsiest like race and segregation allegory I've ever seen put to film, I think, of all of them.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one, but I've heard some commentary on its messaging.
It's got the Zootopia problem of like it wants to tell a story about racism, but in order to do so, it makes like the fictitious black people scary monsters. And so it just like right. it falls completely flat and is not poignant at all. After that, we watched The Boy Next Door.
Yes.
We put that in, and I specifically skipped to the big sex scene because I needed to show everyone exactly what we were working with on the pod.
Oh my god!
After that, we watched The Croods. I don't know if you guys remember The Croods, that like animated movie about the cavemen.
Never saw it, but
it's not good. And I didn't remember how bad it was because I hadn't seen it since I saw it in theaters when I was like 11. And then we watched Vampire's Kiss. And
okay.
That movie like is like genuinely camp. It's so much fun. But then we watched Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, one of my favorite movies. Mm-hmm. I love that movie so much. That movie is like the epitome of like a camp, like bad, like cult classic. It's like tasteless Rocky Horror Picture Show, and for that we love it. And then the one movie we watched all the way through was White Chicks. We put that on and we were like, you know what? We love this so much. We're just going to watch the whole thing.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. And we ended up going until like 4 a.m. And then people had to go home.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. But it was a very successful bad movie night. And we ate a lot of cheesecake. So successful.
I'm glad to hear it.
Successful.
Sounds
you know,
awesome.
25th birthday. The week following has been less good. I've been having a prolonged existential crisis, and it hasn't been fun. But we're getting through. We are making it through.
Aging is never fun.
Yeah, but
well, anyway,
at the
we
party,
see Buck getting an adorable card from Christopher. Eddie's watching, like the proud husband he is.
It has an illustration on the front that like is like them at the beach, which is so harrowing in hindsight.
Right. True, but it's kind of foreshadowing, right? It's like him and Buck with a surfboard, and you know the inside of the card says like, "You are an awesome firefighter."
That's so it's very sweet.
Buck loves it.
They need to go down to the pier sometimes and catch some waves, you know.
Oh yeah, that sounds like a good safe idea. We see that the cake for this party says $1 is worth more than $1 million. So true.
I love this like recurring like cake theme of like just them getting like a dash of like mean spirit in the cake. Like they say like, we got two and so like one was on retainer if you like completely tanked it, and it said better buck next time.
I watched that part and I thought, if Buddy doesn't go canon by the end of season 8, we should make a cake that says better buck next time. Better buck in season 9.
Henren is showing Buck a picture of their sperm donor, but it's like in order to protect his anonymity, they have to show him as like a kid.
It's like a school photo.
Yeah, it's like a school photo.
And so Buck quips, he's like, he looks a little young.
But eventually he says like, you know, something like, you know, he's, I can't wait to see your little guy that age or something like that. And Karen,
he says, like, it's gonna make a great kid. Yeah. Karen switches from like admonishing him for like making the joke about the guy's age to like crying and going, like, you're so sweet.
Is this okay? Is this how hormones work? I don't know.
Mean, I guess I don't really know what kind of injections you need for IVF, but I think the implication is that they're giving her hormone therapy to like make her more like, I don't know, to make her ovulate more or more receptive to getting pregnant. And I think it's reasonable that maybe that would mess with your emotions, but I don't know. I don't know the ins and outs of that.
It was just such a TV moment, TV emotional switch.
Women and their hormones.
But we get like a brief cutaway to Michael in the house. He's stepping into Athena's bedroom. Maybe he just needs some space from the party or something. Because this is Bethina's first party as a married couple, and so he's like reflecting and very pensive. And he sees this picture of Athena and Bobby and Harry and May on like the bedside or like the dresser. And he gets like emotional seeing that. And it's
yeah,
like,
I totally forgot that was even in the episode.
Yeah, because it has no consequence.
It doesn't lead to anything in this episode. Yeah. It's presumably just setting up more for the rest of the season. But
that's Michael's whole thing, is that his entire story plays out in, like, the long game, in, like, two scenes every three episodes. So,
yeah.
You know, I guess we're not really changing stuff up that
hard. He's kind of getting the Eddie treatment.
He is. So Buck ends up talking to Bobby. He's got this, like, what's the word? He's, like, itching at his chest or something, like, where his heart is.
He's starting to look like maybe he's getting a little uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's talking to Bobby. They're kind of having an emotional talk. Buck's thanking him for being there for him during his recovery. He says he knows he wasn't the easiest person to be around all the time. And Bobby's like, you know, it's all good. Like, we're going to get you back at work. Buck eventually starts coughing, and then, you know, Bobby's like, are you good? And Buck keeps coughing. He starts vomiting blood. I am just so obsessed with this scenario where Buck starts horrifically vomiting blood in front of everyone at his own welcome back party, presumably including Christopher.
Yeah.
Like, that was my first thought, as I was like, oh, man. He's doing, like, Christopher's probably watching this.
This
kid cannot catch a break.
This is a scene, like, straight out of a fanfic of, like, you know, like, everything's going well and, like, Buck starts having something, like, harrowing happening to him. And, like,
he turns into, like, Satine from Moulin Rouge.
Yeah. That's a great way of putting it. And, like, everyone's, like, attention turns to him and he, like, collapses and he seizures. Spelling? You know, like, and then we find out at the hospital, because the party ends up being a bust, of course. Buck has to ruin everyone's night. It turns out better Buck next time. It was a pulmonary embolism, a thing caused by blood clots. I'm not a doctor.
It's like when a blood clot hits your lungs.
Yeah, we're not doctors here, but pulmonary, that's the respiratory, so... You know, jot that down. He had a blood clot in his lungs and two more in his leg. You know, it turns out that he was experiencing like symptoms of this, but he thought he had just pulled a muscle and he was kind of like, you know, just like, was like, oh, it's just gonna go away on its own. Man, kids today,
right.
You know?
So when the doctor and Chimney leave, you know, Maddie kind of gets mad at him for not saying anything when he was having, which I was understanding where Buck was coming from here, because yeah, if you were just having like a little discomfort in your leg, even if you had recently had a big thing happen to you, like your mind doesn't immediately go to like, oh, I must have a blood clot, I've got to go to the hospital.
Yeah.
But Maddie thinks he's not being careful enough, and we do hear that he's been pushing himself really hard training to try and get back to work recently, so that could have exacerbated this.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it's kind of the worst job to have, like, an injury like this, you know, because of how physically involved it is, you know. And Buck, like,
yeah, we hear that Buck doesn't even remember vomiting blood at the party. He has one of my favorite Buck, like, lines and delivery, where he says, wait, I vomited blood at Bobby and Athena's house? Like, he doesn't say it like seriously, like at Bobby and Athena's house. He says, like, really raises his voice, like in kind of a comedic way, at Bobby and Athena's house.
This is what I'm saying. His line deliveries this episode have been like cuckoo bananas, and I love
cuckoo
him
bananas,
for that.
Yes.
He was on something else. I think he was just like excited to be back for the third season.
Yeah, he was high on life.
Yeah.
And so we see Athena and Bobby arriving back home, and we hear that Buck called to say, like, sorry about the blood, and, you know.
Sorry about the ruined
party.
Hope
I didn't ruin the party. It's like, well, yeah, I think you did do that.
And they're, like starting to, like, go to clean up. They're like, where do we start? And, like, let me just say, all this food looks absolutely delectable. Like, they're, like, these, like, you can barely see them, but there's like these kebabs like in the frame, and they look so fucking delicious. I just know they're so juicy.
Yeah.
And
it's like, yes, the party got ruined because Buck vomited blood all over your patio, but at least you get to eat all the party food.
Yeah. But of course, Athena goes right to the bottle. Sorry.
Not very sensitive to Bobby being right there. But yeah, she's like, I'm going to start right here. Grabs the bottle of wine.
Of white wine. White wine moment. Hello.
White wine moment.
And, you know, they start talking about, you know, what are they going to do? Bobby is obviously Buck's captain. He can't, like, endanger him by putting him back on the job. And so Bobby is like thinking about like back when he was struggling so much with his own demons, like he was pushing himself mm-hmm. so hard and he ended up like burning out and like you know, basically like collapsing in on himself, and he doesn't want Buck to make the same mistakes that he did. And Athena reminds him that, you know, Buck may not be his kid, you know, like she understands the impulse to like, you know, I think she says like, you know, if May and Harry were like collapsing, you know, my first instinct is to like throw myself under them to cushion the fall. And so she says, you know, Buck may not be your kid, but he's also not you. We don't know what kinds of mistakes mm-hmm. he's making or if he's going to follow the same path that Bobby did. Although,
yeah, I wonder if Athena was kind of putting herself in Buck's shoes, because we've seen that Athena also has that impulse to really want to get back to work immediately when things happen.
Yeah. Good thing we don't have any recent examples of that.
It's interesting that this scene both denies that Buck is Bobby's kid, but also kind of implies it by having Athena first bring up like May and Harry.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you hear him say like, Buck's not my kid, and you're like, I don't believe you, old man.
Yeah.
I also wanted to point out there's a funny line in this scene where they mention how May and Harry are doing, and Athena says, Harry keeps asking if we're sure it's not Ebola. I guess that was a hot topic at the time when this episode came out. Also, like, imagine if Buck just, like, had Ebola and vomited blood at Bobby and Athena's welcome back party because he had Ebola.
That's such a kid thing to, like, to think about. Is like, because, like, you don't think about, like, where would he have gotten it, right? And, like, you just jump to, like, what's in the news? It's Ebola, right?
Because everybody's Ebola talking was, about like, Ebola these days.
There was a, you know, a big, you know, scare about Ebola entering the U.S., And so I do think this inner conflict with Bobby here is like really interesting, because like they're acknowledging, like you said, the family dynamic without, you know, sort of outright like feeding into it. Yeah. And so I guess we leave this scene on like a question mark, you know, is Buck going to be able to go back to work? Obviously, he's in the hospital. What's Bobby going to do? Is he going to put him back out?
Yeah. Athena does say to him, like, he's got to let Buck grow up sometime. So there is an implication that maybe Bobby is being a little too protective of him.
But, like, he also just vomited blood at his own welcome back party.
So. He did. Like, things aren't looking great for Buck. So, yeah, he definitely has a right to be worried.
Imagine approaching this like conflict with like the same level of like vitriol that we just saw like following the Buck and Eddie conflict in the last episode. Like Bobby was being like abusive and manipulative, not letting Buck go back to work right away. It's like, well, the guy collapsed at his own party.
If the fandom had been as big as it is now at the time, I guarantee you there would have been some like Bobby haters. Like, I can't believe Bobby wouldn't let Buck go back to work when he's just a little baby boy that I love and rock to sleep every night. Anyway,
I'm glad Bobby died. He put Buck on light work.
Bobby wanted to put Buck on desk duty, and therefore I enjoyed watching him bleed out.
So we go to a very fun 911 call. Basically, this adult daughter of an elderly man calls 911, not very concerned, with this sort of like passive sort of like annoyance at her dad, like saying he's locked himself in his room and we can't get to him, we need your help. The wedding teen rolls up and they are at a retirement facility, a sort of a retirement mm-hmm. community for people, as you know, I don't have to explain retirement communities.
Yeah, it's like a place where elderly people go to live.
Yeah. And basically, like, they find, like, the guy's room. And, you know, it's not just that the door is locked, but there's something pushed in front of it. The guy, the dad, really doesn't want to see his kids. It's the daughter and the son. And this family is,
this
like,
guy hates his kids.
This is I'm obsessed with the Sopranos-ass family. I love all three of these horrible people.
They're pretty entertaining.
They're very entertaining. They're fighting. Basically, the dad, he has these like sores on his belly, And he doesn't want, like, his kids to come in. He thinks they're, like, ingrateful little shits because, like, they sold his house in order to pay for this this facility.
Yeah.
And Chimney has to come in. What does he say? What's the operation to get into? They say
like you're gonna have to storm the storm the castle.
I think it was storm the Bastille. He was storming the Bastille. Basically, he brings the ladder truck up to the window and hops inside. And lets everyone else in so that they can examine him, and they see that he has these crazy, crazy sores all over his belly, leading down like a happy trail.
Yeah, it's so bad that he thinks it's maybe like MRSA at first, and then Chimney has a moment where he just kind of pauses and he's like, "All right, I'll look." And he, like, you know,
there's this gross like squelching groin sound as they like take his like pants and underwear off.
Yeah, the sound design is
off.
Great. It's like, ugh. Yeah, he looks at the groin area. Everybody kind of is grossed out, and he's like, "I think you have, I forget what it's called, Donovanitis or something."
Donovanitis or something. It's like, it's a flesh eating STD because he's a slut.
Pretty nasty.
Right.
Because he's a slut. And, you know, they're walking down the hallway with the guy afterwards. There's this great exchange where the daughter says, the kids are like, you know, appalled at the fact that their dad is still sexually active. Mm-hmm. And the daughter says, when she went to college, the dad gave her condoms and a can of mace. And the son's like, I only got the mace. And the dad says, I didn't think anyone would have you. I was thinking this dynamic was reminding me of like Frank, Dennis, and Dee from It's Always Sunny.
Very much so. Very much so.
The dad was very Frank.
Just like a dad that hates his kids and kids that hate their dad and also probably each other. It's so perfect.
Yeah.
And
but finally, on their way out, the son, you know, they're in sort of like the common area with all these older people who live at this place. And the son, like, asks all his dad's sexual partners to stand up and come to the hospital because, you know, he's like, my dad has contracted a flesh-eating STI. Like, we need all of you who have slept with him to come to the hospital. So, like, you know, reluctantly, one woman stands up.
There's
gasps. And then, like, multiple women like, start standing up.
Oh, captain, then, like, my captain style. Like
right. And then a man stands up and everybody's like, ooh. And no, it's just a guy being like, what if you've slept with one of the women that he slept with?
And so it's like,
so we've got
this guy,
an outbreak situation.
The son asks the question we're all thinking of, like, what is this place? Like, did I put you in like an orgy facility? Like, people are passing
but, you know,
around sexual
say,
partners like footballs. You know, it's insane.
This is a phenomenon. Retirement homes can be very sexually active places. And you know what? Good for them. As long as they're practicing safe sex, which clearly these people are not.
Are not. But I don't know. I mean, I guess there's no risk of like pregnancy. But listen, there is still a risk of STDs. Even of the flesh-eating variety, apparently. And so we get another line, you know,
Eddie
line drop from Eddie.
Says, kids today.
Kids today. My God. I texted you before we started recording. You, like, they say the episode title and allude to it so many times this ep, it's almost like it's making fun of itself. And I stand by that. Because, like, kids today, like, first of all, it's not a thing anyone's ever said on the show before. And so it's like, it's like trapped. It's like stuck. It's like, oh my goodness. So they're just really hammering it home, huh? That's the title, Kids Today. We go from the, you know, the orgy, basically.
On their way out, Bobby and Hen are walking out and Bobby gets a call and it's from the chief.
Mm.
And we don't see what the chief tells him, but we see him go to the hospital to visit Buck. And they're kind of just having a friendly walk and chat down the halls of the hospital.
Buck is wearing compression tights. I bring that up for no reason.
He's wearing compression tights and his little shorts and hoodie. He looks cute in his compression tights and his long ass legs.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense that he got a bunch of blood clots in his legs because there's just so much leg. There's got to
so
be like so
leg.
Many inches of veins in there. Sorry. I'm not trying to be weird.
Let's be weird.
But
we took a week off. We can be
out,
a little weird.
All right. But we find out that Buck still fully thinks he's coming back, you know, and soon. He's saying like, yeah, like they've got me on the blood thinners. I'm going to be discharged today. And Bobby has to tell him that he's in fact not cleared. The department is concerned about liability issues since Buck has this blood clot problem, and now he's on blood thinners. So, like, if he does get wounded, it could be a bigger problem. He could bleed out more easily. And Bobby's doing that thing where he smiles while talking about serious stuff in this scene.
Minnesota
nice.
Just
like,
Minnesota
right.
Nice.
I think he maybe is trying to put on like a kind of comfortingly friendly face, but it just kind of makes it seem like he's making light of the situation.
Yeah.
But Buck
is
obviously
not
gets really upset.
Well. Yeah, no, he's not taking this well. This is like the beginning of like Buck's downward spiral that we see play out over like the next like five episodes. If not more, where like Buck is like, he's upset because he's already been off duty for 5 months and he's been working really hard to get back to work. And here Bobby is saying, you know, basically all that work was for nothing. You're not going to be back in the field for a long time because
Bobby
got crushed by a goddamn truck. A real
life
truck.
That'll put a damper on things. Bobby says, like, you know, in a little while, maybe you can get cleared for light duty. And this really, Buck really takes this the wrong way. He's like, light duty. Like, you know, you want me sitting behind a desk? And of course, he's Buck and he gets very dramatic about it. And he's really upset. He talks about how, like, out there in the world, helping people, that's where I belong. You know, not sitting behind a desk. And so finally, by the end of this conversation, he's like, I don't want to do light duty. I quit. And he walks out of there.
I must say, it needs be said, Buck, this is not a quitting economy. You don't know how bad the economy's about to get, too. Like, just... You can't even file for unemployment
if you quit. Maybe in 2019.
You know,
there was still, like, a little bit of prosperity in 2019. But, yeah, it was definitely not long for this world.
Oliver did this big sort of emotional melodrama really well. We're talking about his acting a lot in this episode. And I like that. It's like that sort of, like, big theater acting of, like, you know, you have these, like, huge emotions and you're keeping it all inside. But, like, it slips out one by one. I don't know. I like that. It was well done. But Bobby is left looking, like, dejected and, like, I wasn't expecting it to go that way. Fuck. So disappointing.
Yeah.
And after that, okay, I will say something crazy about the scene following is that we go to the fire station, right? And the whole A squad is gathered around the island. Hen, Chimney, and Eddie. And Bobby says, Eddie says Buck hasn't left his apartment in weeks. To the whole group, including Eddie.
I didn't even clock that.
Including Eddie. He just, like, he's speaking for Eddie as if Eddie's not even there. And it's not, like, introducing Eddie to the conversation or anything. Eddie's already in the conversation. And so he's like...
I thought you were going to comment on how that implies that, like, only Eddie would know these things about Buck's leaving his apartment habits.
Well, that also. That as well. But
that,
like,
also.
I was more perturbed by, like, how strange and funny it was that, like, he said this as if Eddie wasn't even in the room.
Listen, classic Eddie getting sidelined. But basically this scene is the 118 talking about how depressed Buck is, and it's crazy because only Hen seems to be truly empathetic to Buck's situation. Everybody else is, like, totally acting like Buck's totally overreacting, and, you know, Eddie's like, oh, he's just sulking, he'll get over it. Chimney is like, you know, how long are we supposed to let him do this? Like, you know, it's been like a week or whatever. This whole storyline has always struck me, and it could have totally been intentional to kind of help justify why Buck would think the lawsuit is justified later down the line. But it did always strike me how I think the team mostly is kind of inconsiderate to how much it's affecting Buck. Not to, I know the fandom, like, babies Buck a lot, but this is one of the times I think it's justified.
Yeah.
Clearly, like, he's made it very clear to everyone that, like, basically his entire joy in life comes from his job as a firefighter. Like, he just doesn't really have a lot else going for him in his view.
Yeah.
And so it always feels to me like, and I guess this is, like, my one critique with kind of the lawsuit storyline is, like, yes, obviously he totally is out of line when he does that. But then after the fact, it doesn't really feel like he ever gets that acknowledgement from anyone about, like, how depressed he was or, like, how, you know, it doesn't seem like people really take his difficulty with this seriously, and I always feel a little bad for him on that front.
Well, that's why the lawsuit storyline is so frustrating to me personally, is because, like, it feels like sort of the show is, like, talking past Buck and it's not, like, taking him seriously. So it does seem like something that you know, someone as reckless and impulsive as Buck would do and, like, you know, push to, like, the brink like this. But at the same time, like, no one, like, takes a moment to, like, really think about, like, man, this has to be, like, tough for him. Like, no one really lingers on that thought, you know? So
yeah, just to, like, validate his feelings even one time.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate what Hen's doing in this scene, trying to vouch for him a little bit. And then we get this crazy line from Eddie where he says, "I know it sucks, but that's life, right? Whenever stuff didn't work out for me, my dad always told me to brush it off, keep moving forward. It wasn't easy, but he wasn't wrong." And I was just like, wow, I love how he thinks this is a good thing that was imparted on him. I was like, Eddie, baby. That's just the generational trauma talking. Like,
yeah.
Kind of good Eddie characterization, I guess, because we're getting an early hint at Eddie's kind of bad relationship with his father. But it's like, damn. So whenever Eddie was struggling in life, his dad would just tell him to brush it off.
You know, it's rough out here.
He's continuing the cycle.
When Ramon is being cited as, like, a positive example of, like, dealing with this shit.
Right? I was like, Eddie, think about it a little harder. Like, it's not good that you were never, that your feelings were never validated. And now you're just doing the same thing to someone else.
Oh, my God. Yeah, maybe there's some introspection to be done there, but that won't happen for quite some time. So we'll hold our breath.
But then there's a good moment where Bobby says, like, Buck has us, even though he might not believe that right now. And then we end the scene just from there. We cut to this lingering shot of Eddie. It's like, okay. Mm. Okay. Mm.
And many fanfics were born. Yes.
Right. But then we go to our friends Josh and Maddie at the Dispatch. They're also talking about Buck. Everyone's talking about Buck. And Josh,
the talk of the town,
is like, yeah, Josh is kind of asking about him. Maddie says that he's sulking at home. He's binging cooking shows. Josh has a really out of pocket line where he says something like, as long as he's binging on the viewing and not the cooking, like the implication that, like, I don't know, he
fat,
like, doesn't
shaming
want Buck,
Buck
to, like, overeat.
Yeah, like, yeah, fat shaming Buck, like, from, like, Josh, from, like, the couch. The you know, it's like, what the fuck? And Maddie's, like, totally, like, on board. It's like, this is, like, the toxic, like gay guy, straight girl, like, friend duo you see at, like, the bar, where they're like, we're keeping each other honest. We haven't eaten since 6:30. Oh, meow, meow, meow. We're not getting any sugary drinks. We're diet partners.
Yeah, because Josh starts talking about, like, I watched a cooking show where, like, this lady used, like, two cans of store-bought frosting for, like, 8 cupcakes or whatever. They just start going off about some random thing. I was like, Josh, why are you doing, like, the man got his leg crushed by a fire truck and now can't do his job that brings him passion anymore. Like, why are we fat?
You would deny this man a cupcake in his time of crisis? Like,
yeah, like, frankly, Buck should have gotten into baking at this point. I was like, Buck should be able to eat as many cupcakes with as much frosting as he wants.
And we know how much Buck loves carbs. We know how much Buck loves carbs.
Yeah, you know? He said that at one point. Come
and we
on.
Saw him, like, devour that slice of cake, so.
Yeah. Yeah, Buck does like carbs, I'm starting to think.
Don't deny him that Maddie, fucking, don't pull a Tommy and be like, Buck's doing the paleo diet or whatever.
The keto diet, the even keto worse diet. Than paleo, the keto diet. Yeah. God, any attempt to dietify Buck will be met with strong hostility from us. You know what?
Yes.
He's beautiful just the way he is, and I think he should be allowed to eat as much dessert as he wants.
I agree.
Because he's a special little boy.
He needs his sweets, okay? He works so hard, and he's just having a really hard time right now. And,
Yeah.
Maddie goes from
being
toxic to...
Maddie says, like, I'm
to...
not sure... Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh. Well, first she says, I'm not sure if I should, you know, comfort him or if I should, like, give him a swift kick and tell him to get on with it. And Josh is like, you know, why not both? Which is kind of true. It's like she can be there for him and also maybe kind of try to encourage him to move on or to get back out there. But then
why is everyone bootstrapping Buck? I'm sorry. Why is everyone like,
I know.
Why is everyone bootstrapping Buck? I don't like this. Like, comfort him. Come on.
I kind of agree. I feel like, for one thing, it'd be one thing if we had, like, seen everybody really try to be there for him and, like, comfort him, and then he's still, like moping and not really accepting the help, that would kind of get the point across. Or if like more time had passed, if it had been like a couple months and he was still doing this, but it sounds like it's been what, like a week? Like I say, like, let him mope for a while. Like, yeah, he's gonna be sad.
No, Bobby did say he hasn't left his apartment in weeks. That is true. It just, it feels
okay,
like...
Okay, did he say that?
I feel like the show is just taking like a shortcut here, and so it makes it a little bit more frustrating because we didn't get to see him mope a lot, and we didn't get to see a lot of people like try and like, you know, be there for him in his time of need. And so we're just hearing about it after the fact.
Yeah, they could have used kind of like what they do after he gets struck by lightning in season six. Spoilers, as if people don't know. But like when everybody's trying to help, like it could be kind of similar to that where like, you know, we see just like one little montage of like everybody coming over and trying to be there for him. And maybe Buck being like really like kind of obtuse and like not accepting the help and being really stubborn and stuff. Then you would kind of understand people's like annoyance a little more. Yeah. But as it is, you just see like Buck having a really painful interaction with Bobby where like he's really crushed emotionally this time.
Yeah.
Not physically. And then you just hear everybody being like, man, Buck's so lazy and annoying. And it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like,
it's like, calm down.
It doesn't communicate, you know, you want to feel sympathetic to Buck and it feels like the characters are not being sympathetic to him.
Definitely. But she sits down to get back to work because it seems like nobody wants to work nowadays. And
exactly.
Maddie gets a call from a woman named Jill who... what appears to have been stabbed and taken to a dark, cramped place. And she is...
First of all, Maddie tells her that she's having trouble hearing her, so take a drink.
Take a drink. Jill is in a bad way. She's in a very bad way. She doesn't know where she is. She's bleeding. Maddie tells her to apply pressure, you know, basic, you know, first responder shit. And is trying to like ascertain her location from like cell towers and stuff and not having a lot of luck, but Josh ends up getting like a ping on like her personal identification from her caller ID or whatever, finds that she has a husband named Rick. Maddie has to call Rick, and she does this like incognito thing where she lies about why she's calling and wants to get in contact with Jill. I don't know why people do this.
I know. I was going to say, I didn't really get why that was necessary. It's not like they're trying to contact him for like unscrupulous reasons.
Yeah.
They have a very real and valid above board reason.
Your wife is dying and needs your help. Where is she? You know?
Yeah. That would kind of get to the point a little faster, you would think.
Although maybe that would like cause him to panic. I don't know. Maybe they need to keep him productive. Rick says that, you know, she was going to the store or wherever to get baby clothes, and then bombshell, Jill was pregnant. So
Jill was pregnant.
Just got even more perilous. And from there, we see a lady in a car getting pulled over by the one and only Athena Grant. And in the back of the car,
this is a very lucky coincidence.
She has a baby carriage with a baby inside. And this lady is like, she's jittery. She's like freaked out. She's like high on adrenaline. She's like, was I speeding? And basically Athena, like, you know, she like takes her license and registration, tells her to get out of the car, cuffs her, notices that she has blood on her hands. And then you start to piece it together.
Yeah.
She has blood on her hands. And she stole the baby from...
She stole this lady's baby right out of the
tummy. Like, oh my God. This just became, like, the most harrowing thing you've heard, like, all day. And then Athena, like, she puts, you know... the kidnapper and attempted murderer down on the sidewalk, cuffed, and looks at the baby, and the baby is so small and like turning blue, and like baby's gonna die. The woman wasn't due for another month. This is a premature baby turning blue with no medical attention. Right. And so,
yeah, she radios for help. She's like, there's a baby in respiratory distress. And the 118 arrives. They like get the baby going in an ambulance with Chimney. Mm-hmm. And Hen realizes that this baby can't be more than an hour old. Mm-hmm. Like the umbilical cord wasn't clipped. There's, you know, this was a hack job. This baby wasn't born in a hospital.
And this baby was freshly C-sectioned, not even delivered, just C-sectioned right out of the mother.
Yep. And they also find in the lady's trunk a fake pregnancy belly. Things aren't looking great for the lady in the car.
This, I had such a visceral reaction because this is like a dark like mirror version of like the Terry Schuster storyline on like season one of Glee. This is evil Terry Schuster like coming home to roost. You know, this is like what she would have like had to resort to. Like if
Glee was like a slightly different genre.
Exactly. If Quinn really didn't want to give up her baby.
Imagine if that's the direction they had taken it.
It turns out that they get in touch with the woman's sister, who she had just gotten lunch with, and find out that she was going to buy baby clothes not from like a mall outlet or anything, but from like a an online seller, like on Etsy or something,
or Craigslist, I think, is probably what they're going for.
Yeah, it's like cheaper. And so she was trying to she did it, but like behind her husband's back or something, because it was like sketchier. But she wanted to save money on the baby clothes.
So the moral of this story, ladies, is never do anything without your husband's approval, because your crazy lady brain doesn't know reason, doesn't know the right thing to do.
Look out
always make sure you check with the old man.
Look out for other women, especially, because, you know, if you don't have a big, strong man to protect you.
Other women are crazy, jealous harpies, and they want your baby, and they want your husband, and they want your life. So let that rock you to sleep at night.
And this is interesting because I was seeing like multiple stories like about this like on Twitter or on the news or something, just people talking about this phenomenon of like, you know, babies being stolen from like women, whether they're, you know, pregnant or, you know, they like just had their children, and like how like violent it is. And so like watching this episode, I'm like, oh shit, this happens like all the time, probably. Like this is
well not like all the time, but like shows all the time. I don't know how common it actually is. There are probably like a couple of really famous examples that have inspired a lot of TV shows and movies and stuff.
There was one.
You see it on the Lifetime channel a lot.
There was one really famous example.
Baby theft is a genre.
I don't remember like the exact like name of the victim involved, but it was something kind of similar to this, where I believe the mother actually died and the baby was like, you know, kidnapped and was returned to the custody of, you know, her father and her family and everything, and is still alive today. But yeah, this is like a harrowing thing that does happen and has happened, so stay sharp. So
I mean, it's not like likely to happen to you, be clear,
but just in case, you know, mace and condoms.
Yeah, always exercise caution when you meet up with somebody from Craigslist. That's definitely good advice. And at one point we hear the kidnapper woman mention that she's named the baby Aria.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, okay, nice Pretty Little Liars reference.
I got back on my Game of Thrones bullshit from that. I'm like, oh my God, Arya Stark, is that you?
Right.
A faceless spelling. Man is born. No, different
and
spelling.
We're kind of getting all this like implied drama going on with the kidnapper. She mentions something about like, but I promised George there would be a baby this time. And you're like, whoa, like there's a whole thing going on there.
Terry Schuster.
That we
Terry Schuster.
Find out about.
Terry Schuster. I'm saying
Terry Schuster. I think that may well have been their inspiration, but it also has like a big Lifetime movie vibe. Like, oh, there's a whole Lifetime plot going on in this woman's life, and we just don't know about it because it's just a singular call in an episode of 911.
She really chose the wrong Craigslist ad.
Right? She was the wrong. I wonder what they would call this if it were a Lifetime wrong movie. Like, it'd probably be something boring, like the wrong mother. I get they already did the wrong mommy.
Did they really?
The wrong baby. Yep.
Wow.
The wrong mommy is a famous one. And it ends with, you know, the villain is about to shoot our protagonist. And she's like, the right life, the right job, the right mommy. And then Dee Wallace, of all people, who plays the Buckley's mother. Yep. Dee Wallace plays the mom in this Lifetime movie. She sneaks up behind the villain with like a shovel or something, and she goes, "More like the wrong mommy," and hits her over the head. It's a classic, classic moment. I've played it many times in my YouTube videos.
Amazing. Amazing. Maddie mentions that she noticed like a whistling sound after Jill's voice cut off in the call after she passed out.
Yeah.
I can't remember how they got to the pony farm. They were going to meet up at the pony farm.
They find out.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They find out from Jill's sister that she was supposed to meet this woman in Griffith Park. So, you know, then they hear that Maddie heard a whistle or a horn on the call. And mm-hmm. Athena happens to be talking to, like, an employee at Griffith Park who doesn't remember the woman but remembers the car. I guess he's a car guy. Mm-hmm. This is a big episode for car guys.
Big episode for car guys, yeah.
Yeah, so they're like, now they know exactly what car they're looking for, but they don't know where it could be when Athena and Bobby notice that there's, like, a kiddie train nearby that makes a train whistle noise.
Yeah.
And so then they like manage to find a space kind of behind the train where cars can be parked, and they see the car, they find it. Jill's in the trunk. She's still alive.
Can I just
Maddie say, finds out over the call.
It doesn't take
she cries on the call.
It doesn't take a lot of repositioning for them to see the car, like around the corner, like peeking out. And so it's like, how did this employee not notice it if he noticed the car already? He's like, oh yeah, that car, she's parked behind the dumpster, you know?
He was probably dealing with all the little kids on the train. You were just talking about how difficult it can be to deal with kids in a service job. He's probably distracted, you know?
That's true. When I have kids in my restaurant, I don't notice anything else. I am just like laser focused on how much I hate these little goblins.
Okay, I feel like you're making us sound like child haters.
I'm making me sound
like
a child hater.
You're going to be on like a child-free subreddit. Like, all right. The opinions expressed by Ryan in this episode are his opinions and do not reflect the overall opinions of the First Risk podcast.
Oh my god, I keep forgetting
many such cases.
I keep forgetting that people wring their hands about this sort of thing. It's such a thing. Like,
I don't know.
It's like a normal thing in the gay community to like not be like thrilled about kids and to like not like want kids that much, and so. I forget that, like, the rest of the world exists where, like, having kids is, like, a big part of your life, and it's an important part, and
well,
it's a thing
that
people
like,
want.
Well, I don't think, like, having kids
you know?
Is really a moral thing. Like, I don't think anyone needs to, like, I don't want kids, but I do think sometimes people can be so over the top in their, like, hatred of kids in a way that feels so unfair to these, like, truly, like, innocent people who can't be held totally accountable for their actions, and really, you know, it is true that kids can be annoying, but yeah, I tend to think, like, that's too bad that the parent isn't doing anything. Or if it's just like a crying baby, it's like nobody can do anything about that. It's like,
yeah,
sometimes you just gotta deal.
Yeah, that's reasonable. That's reasonable. I think I'm just like young and jaded. So I'm hoping that as I grow older in my old age, I'll learn to respect the little minor shit beasts. But that
right.
Day
now
hasn't
that you're
come
25,
yet.
You're basically, you know, almost dead.
I'm ringing the bells. My funeral incoming. Yes.
But anyhow, presumably this park employee was too busy, like, cleaning boogers off the kiddie train to notice that the car was still there. But they find the car, and Jill's still alive, and Maddie cries on the call, so take another drink for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go to the hospital, where Jill is now safe and sound. I mean, relatively, like, presumably she's got a giant, you know, wound in her tummy, but she's gonna be fine, the baby's fine. And the husband is there, Maddie is there, and the husband, like, hugs her, he thanks her so much for doing this, and he takes the baby in to meet the baby's mom. Athena and Bobby show up, and as Maddie is kind of, you know, cooing over this little baby, Bobby says, like, are you and Chimney thinking about that? And Maddie says, you two just got married. Are you like to I don't know, just I guess she's probably people have asked her before about this thing with Chimney and she's annoyed by it.
Yeah. And they all look on as, like, the family is reunited and everything. And it's very sweet. And it's like, oh, they're all parents because, like, you know, Maddie has Buck. You know, like, Athena says, like,
right,
I'm not looking to reset the clock for another 18 years. And Maddie's like, 18? Buck's 28 and I still have my hands full.
Yeah. It's crazy how she is just, like, his parent and his sibling.
It is also crazy that Buck is, like, 28. I'm 25. You're 24. Like, we're catching up to him. Like,
yeah, we're inching closer to Buck Town.
I think Buck was 26 when the show started, so I got one more year on me before I'm Buck age.
Before you're Buck age. But listen, think about, he was still, like fully living like a college student at the age of 26.
True.
So it's like, if anything, we should be encouraged by the fact that Buck was a bit of a late bloomer.
That's
he
true.
Didn't he's like what, like 33 on the show now, and mm-hmm. he still doesn't really have anything figured out. He's an inspiration to us all.
I mean, that's like the thing that I think about is like, how old was like Jess in like the first season of New Girl? She was like 31 or something. And so it's like, you know, it's never too late for your sitcom to start.
Exactly. They make sitcoms about like aging celebrities all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Schitt's Creek, you know.
But then we go to Maddie and Chimney at home.
White wine moment.
A bottle of white wine. White wine moment.
And they're
discussing this mm-hmm. whole thing of like, do we want kids? Should we talk about that? Maddie says that she used to want kids, you know, before she got married.
Yeah.
And then when she was married, she never really felt safe doing that with Doug or around Doug.
Yeah.
And Chimney isn't sure if he'd be a good parent because he's had his own parental troubles, right? Like he had such kind of a broken upbringing. And Maddie also says she's concerned now that she has too much baggage to be a good parent, which is so sad.
It is so sad.
You know, you can be a good parent and have some baggage. But
Chimney also says something pretty relatable in the scene where he says, mm-hmm. Well, I'm still trying to, you know, psych myself up that I'm not still a kid myself. And then he like tosses like popcorn in the air and catches it in his mouth. I'm like, oh, we are all just like big kids, aren't we? Like, adults really don't have anything figured out.
I don't know if anyone ever fully. Yeah. I don't know if anyone ever fully has that moment where they're like, oh, I'm fully a grown up now.
Yeah.
And
if they do,
so
that's
they
probably a red flag.
On being. They settle on being a firm maybe.
Yeah.
They're like, we're a maybe. And then suddenly they're like, are we the only people we know who don't have kids? And then after a moment of considering it, they say in unison, Buck. And then let's talk about the way they transition from someone saying Buck doesn't have kids to Eddie coming over and bringing Christopher.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying the implication is clear.
Yeah.
This is his family, this is his home, this is his child, etc. Yeah.
Smash cut to Buddy Cannon, yes.
Yes,
this,
so we go to
this scene
Buck is in his loft.
Like legendary
bed. He's girl
in Buddy
rotting.
Cannon. He is girl rotting so hard in that bed. He is like, he's bed rotting, he's girl rotting. He is like, TikTok would love him for this.
Yes, he's in his depression cave.
My third week unemployed, not a firefighter anymore. Don't want to get into it, but I'm fine. Get ready with me. Never gets ready.
Get ready with me. Oh my God. Yeah. So Eddie comes over. He's like yanking the blankies off of Buck, which feels so intimate for mm-hmm. two people who have only known each other for one season of television. But like, let's not go there.
Mm.
Eddie is yanking the blankies off of him. And Buck's like, come on, like, I don't have anything to do. And Eddie's like, no, you got to like get out of the house, like take a walk around the block. He like makes him come downstairs. And Buck is not having it, but Eddie's like, your life isn't over just because you're not a firefighter. And he wants Buck to stop feeling sorry for himself. And suddenly Buck walks into his living room and sees that Christopher is there just sitting on his couch. Mm-hmm. Couch theory?
Couch theory.
Anyone?
Mm-hmm. And,
Buck
asks what Chris is doing here. And Eddie gives one of the most legendary line reads in the entire show. He says,
yep.
He's hanging out with his Buck today.
It's Buck.
It's so sweet.
Don't even talk to me.
It's so sweet.
It's crazy. It's crazy that we're at this point already in season 3, episode 1. Like, I'm sorry, but it's crazy.
It is crazy. It is
crazy.
We find out that Carla can't watch Chris because Eddie has a shift and Carla's in Morongo. Good for her.
She's in Morongo.
She should stay at the White Lotus. Yes.
Presumably. I had to kind of look it up. I hadn't really heard of Morongo, but I guess it's what, known for like casinos and stuff.
Is it really? Wait, I'm gonna look this up. I figured it was just like some sort of like,
yeah, no, it's like a casino resort, I believe.
I figured it was like a beachy sort of like place. Oh no, it's in California. Okay, so Morongo's in California. Well, it does seem to have a pool, so good for her. Morongo
Casino
Resort.
Were you perhaps getting it mixed up with the
spa.
Country of Morocco?
It was definitely giving Morocco vibes. But Carla's at Morongo today.
We're giving that girl in the last episode who didn't know Belize was in Central America.
Literally, we didn't know Morongo was in California.
We like made so much fun of her. We were like, she's got to be a dumb teenager for not knowing this, and then look at
Well, they say it like it's like some, like, you know, Mediterranean country, like she's in Morongo on vacation, like, you know, like sipping, you know pina coladas, kicking her feet up on the beach, you know, and right. like having
she might
a good time
still be
with
doing
her husband
that. I think
kid.
It's like, but presumably the implication is like she's out gambling, which, good for her.
Yeah, staycation.
I hope she wins big in Morongo.
Yeah, hopefully she has.
And I hope she watches lots of Mad Max on the hotel TV.
And I hope she knows when to stop. I hope she like has like a cap of like, I can spend this much money and no
right.
more. And like knows when to get off the slots, knows
Carla,
when to leave the blackjack table.
I think knowing Carla, she would be like the one person to just like go there, have perfect luck the whole time,
yeah.
win big, go home with like a huge... huge sum of cash,
and then goes to Morocco. Yes,
and then goes to Morocco with her winnings
and stays at the White Lotus.
Buck
is sort of reticent to sort of take over because he's never like watched Christopher mm-hmm. on his own before. It's always been as a group with Eddie. And
do we know that?
I'm pretty sure we know that. I think it's implied because
I don't think we know that
Eddie says to Buck, you know, he never feels sorry for himself. You know, and so that feels like a moment of like, you're going to spend the day with Chris. Don't baby him. Just like, you know, treat him like any other kid.
Yeah, I guess I think that Buck has probably babysat Chris before at this point.
Interesting. All right.
That's my opinion.
Okay.
I think they're already that much of an instant family.
Well, they, of course, you know, Buck asks him what he likes to do for fun. And so they go to where else but the pier,
the Santa Monica Pier.
That gorgeous
surely nothing could
wheel,
go wrong.
The roller coaster that looks like it's going to collapse at any second, but still looks fun and I would
they
ride
do,
it.
They do a needle drop of This Is the Day by The. Or is it the?
The.
Or is it the?
Is this a group?
It's probably the.
The.
But, you know, that's a confusing name for a band.
Yeah, I'm not crazy about that. I'm not going to lie. That's like Jukebox the Ghost tier for me. I'm not going to lie.
Okay, I think it's a little more chic than Jukebox the Ghost. Speaking of people who like Jukebox the Ghost, shout out to our listener Kyla, who just commented today on one of our episodes that she's listening to it as she's about to walk down the aisle.
Oh!
Congratulations,
we've
Kyla. We've now had people, hope you had a wonderful day. We've now had people listen to the podcast while crashing their car, while visiting the Coliseum. I think somebody said recently they were like shearing alpacas.
Yeah, something. and then they were in,
and on their wedding day,
getting
so
married. Wow, this is huge.
You guys are awesome.
Thank you, guys. We love you. Congratulations, Kyla. We hope your wedding was
magical.
Sorry
about our Caucasian voodoo. I think she was also the one to leave the Caucasian voodoo comment. We do apologize for that. It was not our intention.
Yes, but congratulations on your wedding, and we hope you're very happy and enjoying yourself and happy.
Hope you dance to Jukebox the Ghost.
Happy days
at the reception.
Yeah, they go to the pier and they play that like that water shooter game where Chris wins like a bear and everything. Buck is like coaching him.
Yeah, I guess it's like the one carnival game that's not rigged because they somehow just win it on their first try.
Yeah. Buck is too tall for that like Terrifier ride, like the one where like you're strapped in. It's like the Ferris wheel that like goes like you turn upside down in your seat and it looks like a nightmare. I've never been on it because I was always so scared.
He would be too tall for rides at the carnival.
Yeah.
He's so freakishly tall. He's like 7 feet tall.
Oh, my God. You know, they have a great day. It seems like they're having so much fun. And then they walk to the end of the pier. They sit down on the bench. And then Chris is looking out.
As Chris is winning the bear,
yes.
Buck like looks over to the side and he sees a group of first responders mm-hmm. helping out, hilariously, a man who has collapsed in a dinosaur mascot costume. They're like taking the dinosaur head off of him to presumably he's got like heat stroke or something, and Buck's looking longingly at these first responders helping out, and then, you know, Chris gets his attention again and Buck says, "The universe is mocking me," which is a hilarious thing to say to a 7-year-old.
And they start having this deep conversation on the bench where like Buck asks him about like, you know, what he wants to do with his life, and Chris says he wants to be an astronaut or a pirate, and then he like changes his mind. He's like, I want to be a firefighter. And Buck mm-hmm. like very sadly tells
it's like,
him
read
like
the room, Christopher, okay,
you know, in case any of those career paths don't work out, you just need to find something that you love and that brings you joy and that you're happy with. And Chris tells him that iconic line, "You're gonna be okay, kid."
And then touches his face so tenderly.
So sweet.
I want to say this shot where, you know, we've got just kind of this medium shot on Buck sitting on a bench, like opposite like facing away from the water. And then Chris is stood up on the bench looking out at the water, holding onto the railing. And Buck just like has a fistful of Christopher's shirt to
vice grip.
From falling over the edge. And this is like one of my favorite shots in the whole show. I just think it's such a kind of creative and adorable composition. I love it. Shout out to Jennifer Lynch.
Shout out. That was so good.
Great blocking.
And then, you know, it's like this very poignant, like touching scene. And then Chris goes, "Hey, Buck, look." And then this incredible reveal. This is so well done.
Oof.
This incredible reveal. The Buck turns around and you see the horror on his face, like sort of start to take hold.
We see Buck and all of the bystanders on the pier start to notice. They're all kind of approaching. We just kind of pull away with the camera, zoom out really rapidly, and see that the tide is rapidly receding.
Yeah.
Unnaturally, right?
And then
we get the reverse shot.
I didn't want to.
There's a giant.
I didn't want to say anything about like camera movements because you just went off on Twitter about people not knowing that it's been like a pan and a cut. And so I'm like, what if I don't know what camera movement to say?
Oh God. Well, no, I'm pretty sure, you know, they're pulling out with the camera, right?
Yes.
It's either a zoom out or you know, like some kind of drone shot they're pulling out. Mm-hmm. And we then get the reverse shot. There's a giant fucking wave headed straight for Los Angeles.
Tsunami. It's a tsunami, baby.
Cliffhanger.
Yeah. Cliffhanger.
We are about to go to the tsunami arc.
Yeah.
Wave hanger. Hang 10, everybody. Because guess what? A giant wave is coming to your house.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then, okay, can I just say, like, I was, like, just praising this for how well done this scene is and, like, how... mm-hmm. like how good it is and like effectively conveying like the terror of this moment. But then like it cuts off at a very strange time. The music doesn't even really swell in a way. It just like cuts to black. Like it's like the last episode of The Sopranos. And like, I get that it's a cliffhanger,
yeah,
but like it did feel like a very sloppy editing choice.
Oh, come on. I thought that was very intentional. It was like abrupt and dramatic.
To me, it felt like they ran out of time in the editing bay and they're like, well, we can't, you know, go back and rework this. So we're just going to just cut it off here and it'll work and we'll go to the credits.
I thought it emphasized the shock and awe of the moment and sort of the cliffhanger to leave you like hungry for the next episode.
Yeah. And I thought that
to leave you gagged.
And I thought that if they wanted to do that, they should have actually swelled the music in some sort of way rather than just like having the score play out normally and just like have Buck's like shocked face like sort of in frame for like 1 second and then cut to black.
I'd have to rewatch it, but I remember thinking that was like stylistically abrupt in a way that worked for me.
All right, well listen, I'm not gonna argue with the great Jennifer Lynch, okay? You know, she made her choice
exactly.
for a reason. She's an artist.
Exactly.
And she's sensitive about her shit, you know?
Well, that is a wrap on season 3, episode 1. What a fun episode.
What a banger. We get a lot of good character stuff. A lot of, like, a couple, like, fun 911 calls in this one. And one terrifying one. And also good setup for, like, the character drama of, like, the first act of this season, if you will.
We mentioned having like a few problems with the way kind of the Buck stuff plays out, but I think like this episode is fine. I think it's kind of like I would have been okay with like the show having the characters not be super sympathetic to Buck if that was kind of like addressed later, but I don't think it is, so it's kind of just too bad that that's the way the whole thing played out.
Mm-hmm.
But like I think this episode is a good setup for everything.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. We get to talk about the tsunami next week. We get to talk about
so exciting
the event disaster like thing of like the entire show, like the number one, like in my opinion, like the pinnacle of like 911 disaster episodes. I'm very, very excited about it.
Yeah, probably the best one they ever did. Mm-hmm. I always think it's interesting that this season, and I think the last season as well, unlike the ensuing seasons, they actually don't start off right away with their opening disasters. They do first like a full episode of kind of character setup and like just getting back with our characters. Whereas nowadays it seems like they try to actually like open with, I guess you could argue that like season 7 or season 8 don't get into the opening disaster, like, until maybe the ends of the first episodes as well. But I don't know, it seems like it's, they started marketing it very much as, like, the opening disaster in a new way, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's like, I like that they give that, like, that moment to breathe at the top before we really get into it. It's like, mm-hmm. it's like that whole, like, sort of that thing about, like, how you never open, like, an act of a play in the middle of an argument, you know? You have to give, like, some room to breathe at the top before you really get into it.
It allows us to, like, set up the character stakes for the disaster.
Yes.
Because, you know, if you'll notice in this episode, there are a few little setups for, like, Buck and Chris's relationship. They're really emphasizing that throughout the episode, like, with Buck receiving the card. And obviously, yeah, the surfboard is kind mm-hmm. of, like, actual foreshadowing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I commented on the way we cut from, like, oh, Buck's the only one who doesn't have kids, right to the Christopher thing.
Right.
I commented on that as, like, a buddy thing, which it is. But it's also setting him up to become this big caretaker of Christopher during this disaster.
Yes.
Which, again, is crazy that, like, textually, the point of this is to be like, Buck doesn't have any kids. Oh, wait, yes, he does. That's, like, they were kind of crazy for that.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I am very excited to see how it plays out. I sometimes I'll, like, rewatch, like, my favorite, like, highlights of, like, the tsunami arc. Just for funsies, mm-hmm. like before bed or something, just like to fall asleep, you know, it's like, oh, drift off to sleep thinking of Buck in peril, you know.
Yeah, that's crazy, because as much as I love the tsunami episodes, I also do find them pretty stressful to watch. Like, they're so harrowing.
Yeah.
So, like, I love them, but they're not the kinds of things I would put on before bed, like, to relive.
It's just because, like, I know how it plays out. And so it's like, oh, I have this safe, mm-hmm. like, controlled stimulus, you know what I mean?
Somehow, even though I know how it all plays out and I know everybody's okay in the end, I still find it stressful to, like, watch it all play out and, like, watch that moment where, like, Eddie, you know, thinks for a moment that something terrible has happened. And not to, like, get into our discussion of the next two episodes.
I was just thinking,
right,
like,
now,
oh, yeah, like, next week's gonna be a doozy for you then.
Yeah.
It also,
it's not, like, intensely stressful, but just I don't really rewatch those for fun all the time.
Next week also features, like, probably the most, like one of the most, like, heartbreaking, like, 911 calls, like, that Maddie has to deal with. So
true.
That's gonna be rough. But we'll,
so exciting.
We will talk about that next week on the pod.
Don't forget to rate and review. My dad recently was like, you gotta, like, encourage everybody to rate and review at the end of the episode. I was like, okay, we will wave to you to say goodbye to
goodbye.
This episode.
Well, wait, let's do it like let's do it like cruise attendants, like goodbye, bye bye.
No, you
goodbye.
Did that. You said bye-bye. That the last time.
Oh, I did. Fuck.
And I cut it out of the episode.
Oh,
I didn't love it.
Damn.
What are tsunami related puns? Hope you all enjoy the ebb and flow of the season 8 finale. Wave you later.